Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the synopsis of my cyber opera, Il contadino che ha cancellato qualcosa di importante. The peasant who deleted something important. Act 1. Alfonso and the other peasants are dancing in the square. They have successfully gotten rid of the annoying pop-ups on their computers. The beautiful Marcella steps forward and sings Ho dimenticato la password de finestre. I've forgot my Windows password. Act 2. The townspeople gather in a meadow under a warm morning sun to watch Prince Lenovo attempt the impossible. He sings Posso ottenere l'accesso a questo sito. I can log on to this health insurance website. But now there's a terrible storm. Alfonso cries out that he's made a mistake with the delete key. The chorus sings, Propria connessione di rete è morto. Your net connection is dead. Act 3. A shepherd girl arrives with a system restore disc. She sings, Spegnere quel muro di fuoco. Turn off that firewall. The computers begin to work again, but then the villain, Viroso, hurls their hard drives into the sea. Alfonso sings, Per sempre avremo messaggi di errore. We will forever have error messages. He falls over, dead. The opera ends. Too dark? Today we're discussing the modern uses of opera. And now the lead tenor in the Wi-Fi of Long Island, Colin McEnroe.
Yes, we're taking cyber opera very seriously. Hers sounds a little suspiciously like Rossini, but we'll be in court on that probably, as well as everything else that we talk about today. We are talking about opera, the sort of the present and future uses of opera, the joys of opera, and the challenges faced by opera. With us in studio, we are privileged to have Willie Waters, the former director of Connecticut Opera, and many other things besides, as you'll learn as we go along today. Steve Metcalf was the Currents full-time music critic for over 20 years, and from there, a faculty member and founder and curator of the Garmany Chamber Music Series at Hart School. Anne Majette is in a studio in Washington, D.C. She's the chief classical music critic at the Washington Post. A little bit later in the show, you'll hear a pre-recorded interview with Nico Muhly, who's sort of the bad boy of opera right now. He's got an opera at the Met. Well, you'll learn all about that, two boys. You may have read about it. So I'm going to begin by asking all of you, and let's see. Let's start with Willie Waters on this one. You know, I mean, every day it feels like, not every day, but frequently you pick up the paper and you read some horrible news, like the New York City Opera is declaring bankruptcy. You know, and this can be looked at as part of a larger virus that has taken out a lot of opera companies across America. We used to have a few of them here in Connecticut. We don't so much anymore. San Antonio, Baltimore, they just sort of drop off. On the other hand, if you try to get a ticket to see one of these kind of movie screen operas, one of these you know, multiplexes where they devote a movie screen to, you know, to the actual showing of an opera, those tickets, they sell out. I mean, they pack people into those shows. So it seems like people really, really like opera, but opera companies don't do so well. What's going on here? Can you explain to people who aren't that familiar with it what the problem is, if there is one?
Well, of course there is a problem, but I mean, I would question your statement a bit, only because I've attended many of the HD performances here in the greater Hartford area. And unfortunately, in the last two or three years, they have not been selling well.
Oh.
Even though they've added theaters in both of the places in Hartford, but they've not been selling as well as one would think. And those are small theaters. They've added operas too. The Met has added operas, and so it's a lot for people to make commitments, because you know most of the people who go are 65 and older. So the audience is not, the demographic is not basically changing very much. Certainly in terms of those HDs. I mean, it's basically people who'd rather see good opera at a cheap price rather than go into the theater. So that's what's happening there.
Steve Metcalf, is that the problem, just the demographic changing? Is there another structural problem, you think, that opera faces?
I do think obviously opera shares in some of the woes that afflict classical music and serious music, and for that matter, serious performing arts generally in this country. But I would argue that there's an additional problem with opera, which has to do with repertoire, that you really have this very odd situation, and Willie and I have talked about this over the years, where if you take away the few really big houses in this country, the Met and Chicago Lyric and so on, and instead just talk about the smaller regional companies that of which there are like 100 and some in this country, it's incredible that really, there are about 12 or 14 works, operas, that are done at these houses over and over and over, because those are the works that can sell tickets and sustain the operation. And those 12 or 14 pieces are well known to everybody, and especially well known to the audience. But it's very difficult, I think, to sustain an art form on 14 pieces. And also, you know, the sort of related question that new works are not readily embraced by opera audiences. And so I think those two things are particularly afflicting the opera world.
And Majed, he's kind of setting up a catch-22 here. If you don't do the celebrated war horses, then you'll lose your audience. But if you rely too much on the celebrated war horses, you'll bore your audience to tears and lose the energy that keeps you going. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my answer is you have to move the frame of the picture, which is to say that the opera companies you listed that are folding are larger opera companies. Opera is a hugely expensive art form, but the Baltimore Opera, for example, which has actually been replaced, there's a new company that's springing up to replace them, but they did big standard works. What we are seeing a lot of now are smaller companies doing smaller scale works, a lot of chamber opera, and a lot of those companies are thriving. The Gotham Opera in New York, the Opera Philadelphia is doing a lot of work with smaller, more experimental pieces in different venues and playing around with that. In Washington, in November, we're going to have Urban Arias, which does one-act contemporary operas. We're going to have a new opera about the Holocaust. That's fun. And the Washington National Opera is going to premiere three 20-minute operas as part of its commissioning program. I think opera has actually more appeal to younger audiences than any other form of classical music, certainly than orchestral concerts. There's the drama, there's the excitement, there's the buzz. The Met may be kind of flooding the zone with these HD broadcasts, but I wouldn't take that as a sign of gloom and doom. I think that market will readjust itself. And I also don't take City Opera as a sign of field-wide gloom and doom, because I think that house folded due to a particular constellation of bad decisions and lousy management. And while opera companies are certainly not having an easy time in the current economy, I don't think City Opera is a bellwether in the way people are sometimes taking it.
You know, I just want to probe one thing that you said here for a second, in Majed, and that is the notion that opera has a specific and special appeal to younger audiences, maybe more so than some of the other conventional forms. Is that true, or is it something that could be true? In other words, is it already true that younger audiences are more likely to respond to opera than, say, symphonic music or whatever? Or is it true that if done right, opera should appeal to that audience better?
No, I'm basing it partly anecdotally, and I suppose I no longer qualify as a younger audience, but I know that none of my college roommates had much interest ever in going to an orchestra concert with me, but everybody will go to an opera. There's the drama, there's the sets, there's a sort of general interest. I remember an older friend's daughter who was in her 20s seeing the Met broadcast in Times Square when they did Madame Butterfly and going straight off and buying a ticket because she was so jazzed about that Madame Butterfly. I had some other anecdotal examples of that kind of appeal. And then you have some of these smaller, funkier operas and Philip Glass operas, and you do see younger audiences at that. I think it does have a younger appeal. I have not done the homework. I'm sure that the marketing departments of various opera companies can quote you chapter and verse on the actual ages of people. I'm not seeing a lot of young people at the Washington National Opera, but I think there are companies that are tapping into it very successfully.
You know, I think maybe it's a good idea also to step back and define our terms a little bit more, too, because we're talking about opera, and we're obviously talking sometimes about these grand scale, gaudy, fabulous, large scale operas. On the other hand, we're also talking about chamber opera, and I know whereof you speak to a certain degree. Every year, the New Haven Festival of Arts and Ideas has at least one fabulous, interesting-looking, funky, small-scale chamber opera. But in some ways, I think for the average person who hasn't really followed trends in music, even the ability to link those two things as the same genre in their heads maybe not entirely there umbilically. So maybe let's take a step back, Willie Waters. When we talk about opera, what is an opera? Talking about the form, what is the form?
Well, I've worked with many young artist programs and apprentice programs attached to opera companies in which we take opera into the schools. And we use the basic definition, elementary basic definition, that opera is a story that is sung. And then the second part of that is that it's sung by voices that are trained to project into a large theater over an orchestra. Beyond that, it begins to be a bit murky because, you know, we've had lots of pieces that some are considered operas like Sweeney Todd or not like Sweeney Todd. You know, so that's one of the clearest, I think, definitions that one can use for an opera. It's just a story set to music, most of which is sung.
Metcalf, obviously, maybe a way to adapt it is to say that opera is a story which is sung, but not by Russell Crowe. because Les Mis is a story which
anybody
is...
Anybody ideas?
Well, you know, I've talked about this before. I mean, I'm among those, and I realize there are many who are not, who basically take the position that, you know, you can't on the one hand say that Daughter of the Regiment is a serious piece of art and then say that Candide or Sweeney Todd is not. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just can't do that. And furthermore, if there's a little bit of dialogue in the latter, you know, that doesn't disqualify it either. We were just down actually this past weekend at Goodspeed to see Frank Lesser's Most Happy Fella, mm-hmm. which is a piece I hadn't actually seen in decades. And it's a charming, wonderful piece. It's beautifully crafted. You know, it's wonderfully orchestrated. I imagine he didn't personally do the orchestrations, but nevertheless, it's a great piece. It's certainly a piece that's appropriate for trained voices, as Willie says, and it's operatic in its ambitions. And so I have no problem, no hesitation in calling that an opera, and a very workable, successful one at that. So I do think we have to put those so-called musical theater works in there if we're going to be true to ourselves.
I heard you say thank you, Anne Majet.
I just agree wholeheartedly, and I've had this argument quite a bit because many opera companies are starting to put musicals into their repertory, and it's been a very difficult fight between them and their patrons to figure out how to present these musicals. But I actually had a discussion with somebody who claimed that if it was in English, it really couldn't be an opera, which is a pretty lame definition. Don't tell Nico Muley that. But
Benjamin Britten, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back with more of this. We'd love to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Do you miss opera? Do you miss having opera companies alive and thriving in Connecticut? Not that there aren't any, but maybe not the ones that you remember. Do you love opera? Do you go to see the HD shows at the movies? And what else? Oh, you may tweet us also at WNPR Colin. Yes, absolutely. Go see that, Andy Norell. We have actually the founder curator of the Garmany Chamber Music Series, Steve Metcalf, right here in the studio tomorrow. Go ahead.
Am I in the studio tomorrow?
Oh, no. Tomorrow we have Stephen Metcalf from Slate. We have two
Oh, God.
Stephen Metcalf.
The other Stephen.
Yeah, we have a two Stephen Metcalf
That's
week.
Frightening.
Anyway, Willie Waters is here, the former director of the Connecticut Opera, and many other things besides. Steve Metcalf, as I just said here, this Steve Metcalf. Steve Metcalf 1 is here. And Majed from The Washington Post also with us. We're talking about the present and the future of opera. You know, Anne Majed, as we close this last segment, and I want to repeat the phone number if you want to call in, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Imogen, as you closed the last segment, you were saying, you know, you talk to people sometimes who say if it's in English, it can't possibly be an opera. But what's really happening here, and we'll be talking to Nico Muley, one of the practitioners of this, is increasingly we're seeing operas that are about very contemporary things, that are about the Achille Lauro hijacking. They're about Anna Nicole Smith. They're, as they say on Law and Order, ripped from today's headlines. and you sort of, I mean, it seems to me anyway that that could be a very energizing thing for opera, depending on whether or not it's done well, I guess. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What kinds of themes and topics you're seeing now?
Well, I would say first that opera has always dealt with topical themes. I mean, opera in the 19th century was what Hollywood is today. If there was a popular book, you went out and made an opera of it. Sir Walter Scott, perhaps Willie knows better than I do how many operas were made of Sir Walter Scott books. It's over 100.
Right.
So the idea that that this is somehow new or different, I mean, Offenbach's operettas are all filled with contemporary references. But I would say starting probably with John Adams, Nixon in China, mm-hmm. the idea of doing a contemporary political piece gained great currency. It was seen as a vaguely provocative thing, and there have been dozens and dozens of attempts since then, either taking a political figure like Harvey Milk, a sort of noble operatic figure, or Anna Nicole Smith most recently, an opera by Mark Anthony Turnage that was City Opera's swan song before it bit the dust the other week. But I've seen there's an oratorio of the Alberto Gonzalez hearings by the composer Melissa Dunphy. Basically, you can set anything you want. Opera is about – there should be a dramatic element to opera, I guess, if I were throwing out definitions. And people seek that. And I fear a little bit seek relevance by grabbing contemporary topics. But I certainly would rather see Anna Nicole than yet another opera that's a setting of a famous player book.
The you know, even now the Gotham Chamber Opera, which you mentioned, is doing a version, I think, of Princess of the, and the Pea, but it's done as reality television where there are cameras kind of chasing the people all over the stage. And so, you know, Willie Waters, just to come back to Steve Metcalf's earlier point, that as you look sort of regionally around the country, you know, there are opera companies doing the same 16 operas over and over again. The audience for those, I would assume, is really, I know I said this before, but I want to get you to react to it, is maybe somewhat different than the audience for these funky contemporary operas that often deal with either classic themes in a very contemporary and very technological way, or with very contemporary themes.
Absolutely. And you know, you find in most, I mean, most opera audiences are traditional and conservative. You know, you have some companies like St. Louis, like Santa Fe, New York City Opera in its earlier days, which try to introduce new operas, new and interesting operas. Houston Grand Opera commissioned lots of operas in the 70s and 80s. But you know, it's hard to bring audiences along. And I think one of the major reasons is certainly now we've taken the arts out of the public schools, you know, to the point that kids are not getting exposure, you know, to symphony, to opera, to the arts in general. And so they have nothing to fall back on. They have nothing to compare to, and they have no experience that will lead them to go into the theater.
I see you fidgeting over there.
Well, I was only thinking to myself, and this was actually an idea that popped into my head as we were watching Most Happy Fella last week. You know, this is a sort of a cliche, I suppose, to say, but there really is an interesting and uniquely operatic question, I think, centering around the idea of tune or melody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a this kind of odd catch-22, more so, I think, in opera than say, symphonic music. And in fact, if I may, I want to quote briefly from Tony Tomasini's review of Nico's Two Boys, in which he says, quote, "There is none of the cheap melodrama of neo-romantic styles that you hear too often in new operas," unquote. Now, I think we sort of know what he meant, and I think that, you know, maybe we even sort of agree with it. But on the other hand, it veers dangerously close to saying if you stop and have a sort of diatonic tune, you know, you're going to pay for it. And there's a sort of an odd contradiction going on, I think. Even among hipper, younger people, I think the idea of tune is not lost. And yet, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, critics and others and other hipsters, you know, are suspicious of it. And it's a difficult corner that we've painted ourselves into.
Well, you know, and Majet, again, you know, he sets up kind of an interesting collision course here. On the one hand, you've got an audience that, in the words of Stephen Sondheim, wants a tune you can hum. And then you've got
I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit.
I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit. And on the other hand, you've got an audience that he's imputing a problem to with that, an audience that is going to listen to that song, going to listen to that tune, that hummable part of a modern opera and say, well, that's not cool.
I had a friend who said she didn't want to hear Britain's Peter Grimes because of all the ugly modern music. Britain's Peter Grimes being one of the most melodic pieces in the repertoire.
No,
but to her, it was contemporary and new and scary. So I think there's a lot of context and mental preparation or mental obstacle to this. One thing that intrigued me that a company director told me a couple of years ago was that you had a lot of American regional opera companies grow up in the 70s in the wake of the Met stopping touring. There was an audience with an appetite for opera that no longer had a touring company coming through. Regional operas grew up. Those audiences have now matured, and they've heard a whole bunch of La Bohème's, and they've heard a whole bunch of those 14 operas, and the audiences themselves are starting to get a little restless. Mm. It's now evidently harder to sell a Rigoletto than it used to be, but they don't quite know what they want to replace it. And so you're seeing a lot more new opera at a lot more houses in the last couple of years than we had seen before that. San Francisco did two new main stage operas within 3 months this calendar year, one in June and one in September. The one in September based on Stephen King's novel Dolores Claiborne, if you want a topical topic, and the other one based on The Gospel According to Mary. But I think that there is more of an appetite for that kind of music, but then you're getting people who are indeed looking for tunes. And a large problem with a lot of contemporary opera, as you say, Stephen, is that there's a convoluted, tortured quality to people trying to write well for the voice and write melodically without committing the sin of lapsing into an actual melody.
And it's complicated because I don't mind saying, and I have certainly irritated many of my friends with this, I don't mind saying that even though I have no problem calling Les Mis or Miss Saigon contemporary operas, I find that music very boring and derivative and dumb, and I think I Dreamed a Dream is one of the worst tunes of the last 50 years, and yet I know plenty of people who really, you know, find it very satisfying, and you know, so I mean, it really is in the ear of the beholder in a kind of crazy way.
But Willie,
you know, you also know it when you hear it. I think that in general, Peter Grimes is a very compelling, or Wozzeck, a great example of an opera people think they're not going to like, by Alban Berg, because it's a contemporary, challengingly non-tonal piece, and yet it's incredibly powerful dramatically, incredibly beautifully constructed, and it usually gets a very powerful reaction from the audience once they get into the theater.
I mean, Willie, maybe this goes back to some of your points about education, too, because ultimately, in order to have the thing that we're talking about, you've got to have a generation of composers who came along who were hip enough and cool enough to be making really interesting modern operas, but also sufficiently imbued in musical tradition so that they can write tuneful modern opera, so that an idiot like me, I might be really attracted to the idea of, wow, a Stephen King novel that you turned into an, I mean, I'll go see that. But then if I'm assaulted with kind of a lot of atonal music that I'm just, you know, not cool enough to handle, then that might be my last visit to the opera. But is part of it just, you know, the creators, the composers, having those people who can kind of work both sides of that street?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, I would like to, you know, when I was coming up in the operatic world, I mean, we would say there were a lot of contemporary operas that were sort of classroom exercises, that composers wrote them for their own edification and not for audiences, because certainly at that time, we're talking about the 70s and 80s, audiences were indeed, as I think they still are, traditional and conservative. So it's hard to get people, you know, to do something new and different in opera. And it's very strange, because in most other things in our lives, we do things, we change, we do new things all the time. But for some reason in opera, we get stuck in, you know, something that keeps us from going further. And I maintain, though, that if we can get people into the theater, we can make the case for a lot of these pieces, but it's getting them there that's the problem.
Let me go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, to take the melody idea one tortured step further, you know, Sondheim, who you just quoted, Colin, from Merrily, you know, is a very instructive example. Of course, he's an instructive example about a lot of things. But, I mean, in the narrow question of melody, you know, how many times do we read or hear from people about, you know, Sondheim, you know, I enjoy the shows, but they're just, you know, where are the tunes? Where are the melodies a la Richard Rodgers and stuff? Well, of course, I think most of us who spend half a minute with Sunday in the Park or Into the Woods or Sweeney certainly would say, you know, these are fantastic
lots of melodies.
And then they are every bit the equal of Rodgers and Gershwin and whatever, you know. So clearly melody and modernism, you know, are wrapped in this kind of complicated dance that I'm not sure we've figured out yet.
Let me grab a call.
Well, let's remember that when Carmen premiered, people hated it because it had no melody. Just remember.
Yeah, but about 10 years later, that was all gone away. I mean, most of the standard rep operas were standard rep within 8 or 10 years.
Let me grab a call here from Carolyn in Walcott. We're going to have an interview with Nicole Muley in just a second here, but here's Carolyn in Walcott. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
So I'm a private voice instructor. I teach at Summit Studios in Manchester, and I am very much enjoying this conversation. What I have to say, though, I was agreeing with what you guys were saying before about getting kids, you know, exposed to opera and just getting rid of their even negative connotations that they might have about it. But I feel like, you know, being an instructor, half the time it's getting it past the parents, which I find very strange. you know, kids, parents want their kids to be studying for, you know, their American Idol debut as opposed to the longevity of their singing voices. And I was wondering what your guest had to say about that.
Parents who don't foster this? You're nodding.
Well,
you have to answer. Or Anne, you can answer.
And then go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that the lack of arts education is a symptom rather than a cause to begin with. And I think what you've just said about the parents really bears that out, because if today's generation doesn't have arts education, the parents' generation did have some arts education and it didn't make a huge difference. I think our society is shifting in powerful ways, and that arts education today would be a very different thing than it was in the 50s. It wouldn't focus only on classical music, nor should it, because our society is a much bigger place musically than only classical music, much as I love that. But I think that I've said over and over, I think it's the 40 and 50-year-olds, 30, 40, and 50-year-olds people should be really working to target, because that's the generation that's really stopped going. And if they don't go, the kids aren't going to follow them.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, having grown up in a town whose public school system had fantastic and continues, blessedly, to have fantastic music programs and music education, you know, it doesn't necessarily follow. I hate to break this to you, Willie, but it doesn't necessarily follow that waves of those kids, you know, are going to be buying tickets to Die Frau on a Schott in, you know, in New York. So, you know, it's a much larger cultural phenomenon than, I'm afraid, than just public school music programs.
Yeah, but my point is probably more appreciation than anything else. I mean, at least if they're exposed to it, then they can make a judgment. You know, yes, I'm going to go, not I'm going to go. But if they aren't exposed to it, then, you know, they take, you know, their responsibility from other people, and then they say, no, this is terrible. I mean, they're all true. You know, it's just finding a way to break that barrier, and this is something we've been struggling with from the 60s and 70s when I first started an opera.
All right, so we're going to end this segment, and it's a somewhat long interview, so I want to get to it so we'll have time to respond at the end with an interview that I did yesterday with Nicole Muley. He is he's the bad boy of opera these days. He's got a show at the Met. He'll tell you all about it, though. Here's our interview with Nicole Muley. Nicole Muley is one of the bright lights of this world that we're talking about today. He's a composer and arranger based in New York City. He's joining us by phone. Two Boys runs through November 14th at the Metropolitan Opera at Lincoln Center. It doesn't get much better than this. His first full-scale opera, Two Boys, was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera, Lincoln Center, and the English National Opera. It is creating all kinds of waves all over this place. Nicole Muley, first of all, for people who haven't been following all the press, give people a sense of what the opera is about.
The opera, it takes place about 12 years ago in the sort of early days of chat rooms, and basically follows the story of a policewoman who's a creature of the analog world who's asked to solve a crime that seems quite simple, where an older boy pretty plainly stabbed a younger boy. And in the process of investigating this, she realizes that a lot of the motivation and a lot of the intrigue of what happened, the sort of backstory, happened online. And as such, she has to sort of familiarize herself with this somewhat terrifying landscape.
So you're trying to do a whole bunch of different things here. One of the things is to create different musical signatures for what happens online versus the flesh and blood world, right?
Right. That's one of the challenges of the piece.
Talk about how you address that challenge. In other words, you're really writing music in pretty different styles for those two landscapes?
Style is a weird and loaded word. I mean, I tried to do it as best I could. First of all, it's an entirely acoustic opera, so I didn't avail myself of any synthesizers or pre-recorded elements. So instead, what you have is that the chorus becomes part of the texture of the online world. And so what I did was I wrote very simple harmonic music for them, but then gave each chorister a separate piece of text to repeat on sort of any given note. So what you end up with is this kind of shimmering bowl of kind of infinite information.
Let's give people a sense of this. We'll play just a little bit of the Act Two chorus, "I Saw You in Algebra."
Thank you.
So, Nico Muhly, tell us what's going on in that chorus.
What's going on in that chorus is that we've just had a very intense real-life interaction. It's the first meeting in actual flesh space between these two boys, and as their relationship sort of intensifies, the chorus starts painting this very milky picture of life online, during which the text that Megan Meyer, who was a young girl who killed herself a couple of years ago, it was the text that she was sent right before she hanged herself, sung by two members of the Metropolitan Opera Chorus. So what you have is this idea that even if you're casually observing online, there's always someone cajoling someone else to do something terrible or someone sort of emotionally manipulating someone else.
Throughout the opera, we have this, you know, very high-sounding music, this very high-culture-sounding music, but what's coming out of people's mouths is often the sort of more pedestrian kind of speech that one encounters in high school, that one encounters in middle school, that one encounters online. And obviously, it's meant quite seriously. Do you feel that there's a little bit of a tension sometimes between just the majesty of the music and what people are actually saying?
I would disagree right from the beginning of your statement that there is music that sounds like high culture. That sounds like a very strange thing for one human being to say to another human being. So I'd advise you to rethink that just as it relates to your own life. But also, I mean, I think opera has always concerned itself not with being lofty at all, but by being quite mundane. I mean, in the beginning of The Marriage of Figaro is essentially a trip to Home Depot. I mean, it doesn't get poetic until much later. So no, I mean, I think there's a tension because the language itself is not very poetic, the way people speak to each other online, but that's sort of what we were going for. So it's deliberately tense.
So in a way, you've prefaced my next question, which is that you're obviously sort of mining, as a lot of people writing opera these days are, mining contemporary events for operatic subjects. I'm assuming what you would say is this really isn't necessarily all that new. It's just that when we look at classic opera, what we don't understand is that they were essentially doing the same thing.
Yes, quite. And I think, you know, and opera has always engaged, you know, either super directly or in a kind of code with the world it inhabits, if that makes sense. Like, you know, I think in a lot of Mozart operas, of course, they can be read allegorically as, you know, representations of his community. It's a strange thing to think that opera needs to concern itself only with mythic. I mean, I think there's so many examples of the operatic in our daily lives that sort of makes sense to me.
So do you find that you are, I mean, I saw, for example, you didn't ask me anything on Reddit. Somebody asked you about other operatic subjects, and you directed them to a New York Magazine article about a divorce within the Orthodox Jewish community that, according to New York Magazine, has achieved the status of urban legend in Orthodox communities from New York to Jerusalem. It involves accusations of bribery. It's being called a Hasidic version of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce, the Dickens Bleak House case.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, what's amazing about that is that it's so specific to this one community, but it's also something that we all totally understand, which is the complicated ways in which an arranged marriage can go south.
In other words, as you're encountering the real world, you're encountering the news around you. To you, that's operatic fodder.
It seems like it. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this is not in any way to put down the work that other people have done, but I think in a lot of cases, if something is a good book, it's a good book. It doesn't necessarily need to be turned into an opera, mm-hmm. or something that, you know, in mythology, I like that myths are told sort of orally. I'm not sure that I want to see it on the stage, if that makes sense. But again, this is a very personal thing. Like, the things that intrigue and arouse me are in the news.
Another thing that you are, I think, you know, at 32, you're sort of an opera composer. This is a fairly new thing, an opera composer who's lived a lot of your life online, too. You know, you really have a very active Twitter feed with lots of followers. You know, as we just said, you didn't ask me anything on Reddit. Are you getting a sense, as you hear from audiences that see the opera Two Boys, that generation, which has lived a lot of its life online, gets this opera in a way that maybe somebody who's 55, 60, 65 doesn't, because so little of their lives has been lived on the digital platforms?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think to a certain extent that is true because, you know, people specifically my age have told me, oh, that's so crazy. Like, when I saw that, I recognized my literal own own self in high school doing those exact things. But in this opera, our narrator is an offline creature. This is a woman who is in her 50s, we assume, and who belongs to a generation who's used to getting information and used to getting she's used to having information presented to her in a very specifically analog way. So in that sense, I think that, you know, the opera shouldn't be alienating to people in their 50s and 60s, and in fact they have a very good sort of tour guide through hell in this offline detective.
Do you also sense in the work that you're doing right now, obviously you are heir to a modern tradition that includes Philip Glass and Steve Reich and Meredith Monk and people like that, but you also cite as influences people like Paul Simon, Tracy Chapman, Sufjan Stevens is somebody I know you've already collaborated with. Is there kind of a sense now that what opera is a little less segregated and that a lot of different kinds or styles of musical composers can work in the opera genre?
No, I mean, I don't really worry too much about genre because it stopped being relevant when they closed the record stores, right? Mm-hmm. And opera used to be, as you pointed out, opera used to be the craziest place in the record store. Like, you'd walk into the store and then you'd have to go into the classical section, which itself was, you know, cordoned off. And then, and, you know, it felt like you were buying porn, right? And then you went into the opera section and it was even crazier and the people were even more kind of dire. I'm not sure that it's a question of the style of music. I mean, I think the piece that I just wrote is a very specific construction. It's a grand opera. It's for unamplified singers and orchestra. It belongs in a space that does that, which isn't to say that something like that there isn't room for something like Steve Reich's The Cave, which I think is one of the high water marks of like Western civilization, which is for, you know, a small ensemble of amplified instruments, a small ensemble of amplified voices, and a bunch of video screens. I just don't worry too much about it. I think opera's going to be fine.
You think opera's going to be fine? I mean, structurally, as you look around the country in places that are not the Met, obviously the classic style of doing opera is harder and harder to do. The economics really militate against the form in a lot of ways. Although, obviously, if you're sort of following chamber orchestra, an awful lot of the really exciting artistic statements being made these days are being made as chamber opera. When you say opera's going to be fine, what do you mean?
I think the audience's hunger for stories told through song is not going to go away. Whether or not that means that there's going to be a focus on chamber work, or whether or not that means there's going to be a sort of refined focus on fewer grand pieces, I can't predict that. But I think anxiety about the future of the genre is really not helping anyone. it assumes a past that I think is false, and it also, I think you'll find that most people who have something to say about the future of anything are in some weird way being paid for this. If that makes sense, they're not doing it as a service to humankind, right? You'll find that on the back end, someone's on the take.
Well, do you worry that you'll find that? I mean, having worked on this scale, I mean, it really doesn't get better than this. It's the Met. It doesn't get better than this. And who knows? Maybe you'll have 20 more opportunities over the course of your career to do it at this level, at this scale. Are you a little worried that it might, having seen Paris, it might be hard to go back to a smaller scale opera?
No, I have to say, the scale is obviously, it's thrilling and insane, and you know, it's just so exciting. But no, I always look forward to making works in different sizes. You know, the other day I heard a piece of mine that I wrote for Hilary Hahn, which is just her, you know, against a drone. And you can still, you know, there are ways to, as a composer, I think it's good to be able to work in different scales and keep all those muscles working.
You know, you sort of already answered this question in a way, but why opera specifically? In other words, there's lots of ways to tell a story, and you know, if you walk around New York, there are an awful lot of people doing musicals, which are songs interspersed with spoken word. What's the specific power of opera? Why do you want to work in that form?
I mean, for me, it has to do with the quality of the voices. Mm-hmm. I've yet to really fall in love with a musical theater voice. Mm-hmm. For me, what's so miraculous about opera is that it is this insane tightrope walk of technique, of language, of just working with the acoustics of an enormous space that you don't find in musical theater. I mean, the argument like opera versus musical theater is another boring one too, because, you know, I always feel like if, you know, 10 minutes spent worrying about that is 10 minutes you could spend like learning German or doing something useful with your life. So in terms of a form of expression, I mean, you try to make a piece that fits the constraints of the commission, if that makes sense. Like, the Met asks for a piece, I'm going to give them a grand opera. I'm not going to be like, here's my weird like 9 synthesizer Tron video opera.
Well, you know, that brings me back to the question that irritated you. I'm just going to ask it one more time before you go. You know, I was asking you before about style, and I probably phrased it the wrong way. But, you know, in some ways, listening to Du Bois, there is a way of singing, an operatic voice, as you just described, a technique, as you described. And then coming out of that technique, you know, you might hear a line like "the stud that wants to get you off," which I think people aren't used to hearing in that operatic voice, in that using
well,
that technique.
They aren't. I mean, it's, you know, if you listen to Don Giovanni, it's a rape diary the whole first 20 minutes. I mean, I think the specific words, yes, there are moments of dissonance between the beauty of the thing, but what's fun about opera is that the people who sing it are people, and they're people who have lived lives, and they're actors who can bring their experiences as human beings to, you know, interpreting a hard line like, you know, gob on it or whatever, which is how people talk to each other online.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Nico Muhly, it's so great to talk to you. Congratulations on your success. We're going to close with a little bit more from the opera Du Bois. Why don't we play a little bit of I'm Only 16? And Nico, as the audience is listening to this, and this NPR audience, they like opera, but maybe they're not too familiar with what you've done or the vein that you're working in. What do you want them to listen to as they listen to a little bit of this?
This is an aria from the first act of the opera, and it's less of an aria and more of a swelling in the road, where we have this young boy who's trying to explain to this woman why it is that he sort of throws himself at the mercy of the computer instead of actually engaging with his parents or friends. At the beginning, it's sort of herky-jerky and him, you know, being nervous and uncomfortable, and then all of a sudden, as he sort of gets into the rhythm of his story and into the rhythm of the sort of elegance of what it's like to not have to deal with people offline, but to basically submerge yourself in this bath of online relationships, the music sort of assumes a regular heartbeat and a regular footprint, which I think is pretty clear.
All right, Nico Muhly, so great to talk to you. And let's end with I'm Only 16.
Today's opera, The Misplaced Amazon Order, was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our intern, Tess Aronson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Placido Domingo. Tweetmaster Greg Hill is watching over WNPR Colin from the mezzanine seats. Check out WNPR.org for audio, photos, and extras. On tomorrow's show, we revisit our conversation about the possible death of the humanities. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. We're still talking about opera in the studio. Willie Waters and Steve Metcalf on the line from the Washington Post, actually from the Washington Studios. Anne Majette is with us. She's a critic for the Washington Post. So much to cover and so little time that's left. Anne Majette, I think it's fair to say that actually you weren't entirely a fan of Nico Muhly's opera. So if you didn't like it, what didn't you like about it? Did you not like it as opera or did you just not like the music?
No, I thought the choral writing was wonderful. I thought he had some of the same trouble with the arias that we were talking about before. It's difficult to write well for the solo voice and to figure out how you want to do that dramatically. And I thought the libretto was a big problem. I thought it was odd that somebody as hip and with it as Nico presented a piece that was really about sort of the perils of this evil place, the internet, which was, I think, largely based on the input from the librettist, who was an older person who maybe wasn't quite as plugged into the internet. But it became this very sort of moralistic tale about these horrible identity shifts that can happen on the internet, which we all know about, but it seemed a little naive to me. I didn't. There was a lot of great. There were a lot of great things about it, and the performances were super. There was some really good singing, but I was a little disappointed overall.
Steve Metcalf, I'm going to ask you the question that I asked him. There's something. There's a clash. There's a clash that's almost comic about this pedestrian vernacular language sung in this high operatic style. At times, is there a way to solve that if you're going to write in a contemporary vein? If you're going to write about contemporary figures, contemporary issues, how do you make it sound operatic and not goofy?
Yeah, well, yeah, goofy. It is a tough one. Well, you know, in a way, it kind of reminds me of yet another Sondheim lesson here. You know, people have asked Sondheim over the years whether he thinks his shows are operas, and he very often answers by saying that he is not a fan of this sort of trained, you know, operatic, if you will, voice, and that when he thinks of his material, he thinks of it as being rendered more by, you know, kind of straight ahead Broadway voices, non-legit voices, as some people say in the business. And I think that's what ordinary people perceive. I mean, it's even little kids, you know, when you talk about opera, they suddenly, you know, do this kind of parody of what they think a, you know, serious voice sounds like. And I think that's the problem. We're not accustomed to hearing those kinds of words come out of that kind of voice.
You know, Willie, is there some fundamental bargain that we could almost lose here that is at the heart, at least, of the classical understanding of opera? You know, the more technology that gets piled in here, the more that we, you know, really do have all kinds of not only new themes, but new technologies, new ways of staging opera. You know, there's this older idea that there's this big space and this big music, and these unmiked voices are almost athletically going to address the problem of filling this space and connecting with the audience. That's what opera is. It's really this kind of massive and, as I say, almost athletic undertaking to do something like that. Is that part of opera that kind of has to stay to keep you engaged as an opera performer?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it is, because then why have the two different genres? You know, then, you know, I mean, it would all meld into one. And as I said earlier, a lot of the lines are being blurred now anyway. But one of the distinctive things about opera is the use of the human voice, the way the voice is trained and the way the voice is used to perform this music, which generally is not done in musical theater, although there are a lot of legit theater voices, you know, that sing a lot of, you know, legit things in theater. But it's not just as prominent or as prevalent in musical theater. But I think that's an important part about opera, and I don't think we should apologize for it. You know, that's what it is, and people just have to get used to it. But it's that getting used to that becomes the problem.
And as
I play devil's advocate for a minute, that Broadway was not amplified two generations ago.
Right, exactly.
Broadway singers were legitimate voices in the sense that opera voices are. And that distinction is so recent that it feels funny to me to push Broadway away as not legitimate when the John Raitts and Mary Martins of this world and Ethel Merman, goodness knows, had amazing voices.
I agree.
But it's still true at another level that a lot of the early so-called crossover albums in which opera singers, you know, attempted to sing Gershwin and Porter and stuff were fairly risible in their, you know, in their sort of results. And I don't mean to pick on any particular one, including Kiri Takanawa, but I mean they didn't succeed, and I think that, you know, artists these days either don't attempt it or they try to rein it in somehow.
I think a lot of
but
that has as much to do with style, also the style of singing, in addition to the quality of the voice.
Right, but
can't really be prescriptive about this stuff because there are people who are going to do it well. It's sort of like the question of how can you set the voice to sound good or bad with the words that you're getting thrown at you.
Yeah.
Some composers have a knack for it. Some composers don't. Some composers are finding their way, but there's not one way to do it right.
Yeah,
I agree.
All right. I don't dare ask another question because we're essentially out of time here. This has been really fun, though. Willie Waters, great to have you in studio. Steve Metcalf, also great to have you back. Anne Majette, first time from The Washington Post. I'm sure we'll talk to you again. She's a chief classical music critic at The Washington Post. We also talked to Nico Muley. Tomorrow, we are going to have another Steve Metcalf on, Steve Metcalf from Slate. It's actually a rebroadcast of a show we did about the humanities. There's yet another round of soul-searching and garment-rending going on right now about the future of humanities in colleges and universities. You will hear on this show, if you didn't hear it the first time, a smackdown, it can only be called that, between Steve Metcalf II of Slate Magazine and Stanley Fish, who I think went on the air expecting to get along and didn't get along so much. If you listen for no other reason, listen for the titanic battle between Metcalf and Fish. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back with The Nose on Friday.
I'm Kion Wolf. My next opera is called Il sono un cattivito schimmia senza cervello. And Google Translate says that's I'm a bad monkey with no brains? Huh. I think it's going to be a hit.